Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Welcome to Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, and it's wonderful to have you with us this weekend because we are going to take a look at some of the trending news related to the rights of children, the well-being of children, and the protection of children. And so, of course, I was delighted when we happened to turn to Matthew 18 this morning when my 15-year-old and I did our Bible time together. We always drive a little bit early to the bus stop, and then we sit and read scripture together. We've been going through Matthew, and of course, we get to the passage that really serves as a huge motivator for me when it comes to the work of Them Before Us. And it is this famous verse that no doubt you are aware of, but it says, whoever causes one of these little ones to stumble, he's talking about kids, who believes in me to stumble, it would be better for him to have a heavy millstone hung around his neck and to be drowned in the depths of the sea. And my son was like, what is a millstone? And I'm like, think about it like this. Think about it. And I mean, this is like pretty graphic. God puts you standing in a tank of wet cement, and then you stand there until the cement hardens, and then he throws you into the sea, and you drown a terrible death. So he didn't just say, you're going to have to face consequences if you cause little ones to stumble. He says, I have devised cruel and unusual punishment if you cause little ones to stumble. And so this is one of the primary motivators for Christians across the world and across eras when it comes to applying biblical truth to their current cultural context. We see missionaries in China who opposed things like foot binding for little girls. We see people like Amy Carmichael literally snatching children out of temples so that they are no longer serving as sexual prostitutes in the name of worship. We see people like G.K. Chesterton opposing the eugenics movement in the early 1900s because it would mean that children would be bred like cattle and they would not be able to be born free. They would be products. We see that Christians make a difference when it comes to child protection all across the world because they understand that God holds us responsible if we allow child victimization to take place when we could do something to change it. So, we are going to talk about different aspects of child victimization here in this radio show, but we do that every week. So I am glad that you're willing to give us a little bit of your time because I know that this has not necessarily been a dominant aspect of the Christian lexicon, you know, for the last couple decades at least. But it's true that child protection is and always has been one manifestation of our pure and undefiled religion before God. And while we are not facing the threats of sexual prostitution in idolatrous temples or child mutilation in the name of foot binding, we are seeing child victimization in a new and novel way here in our country. And we Christians need to stand up and fight against it. So I am welcoming my training director, Jen Friesen, on a little bit early today. She's going to help me hit some of the trending news, and then we're going to take your Q&A and our last segment. But Jen, any thoughts on Bible time today and what it means for you and how you think about child protection?
It made me think of that quote. I have no idea who it's from that says that all that's necessary for people to do evil is for good men to do nothing. You know, did that come from around World War II or something? But it occurs to me that God is just, I mean, in this passage, he's talking about the people that you're actively doing something to hurt other people. But to your point, there's some of us that we aren't maybe actively doing something to hurt children, but we're standing by silently watching it happen. And it seems like, honestly, is that going to be so much better if you have to stand before an eternal judge and say, well, I didn't do anything actively. Well, you stood there and did nothing. You know, are we complicit? So that's a very sobering thought for sure.
Yeah. Amy Carmichael was not sacrificing children to sexual idolatry, and Christian missionaries were not binding the feet of the children in their home, but they also would not let the culture around them victimize children. They rescued individual kids wherever they could, but they also pressed for and succeeded much of the time in changing the culture and changing society through these biblical ideas of child protection. So we're going to hit a few headlines today because there is a lot happening in the news. There was a new report that came out just last week. I believe that we covered it on the radio show, that showed that the abortion pill, mifepristone, which is one of the most widely distributed medications today, it is now mainstream. And now we're at the point where the abortion pill or chemical abortions is responsible for about 2/3 of abortion in this country. So when Roe versus Wade was overturned, we still had a dominant number of people who were getting abortions through abortion clinics. That is no longer the case. Now, it is not a question or decision between a woman and her doctor. It's very often a decision between a woman and her mailbox, because these pills are being sent directly to her. Now, our friends at the Ethics and Public Policy Center came out with a groundbreaking report that showed that major medical risks to women from the abortion pill were not the 0.5% like they had been advertising. They had marketed this pill as, well, it's as safe as Tylenol. Turns out it's not. It looks like about 1 in 9 women are going to have severe medical complications. Severe, not cramps, not headaches, hemorrhaging, bleeding, sepsis, death. And yet, what we saw this week was the Trump administration defending Biden's abortion pill regime. We saw that the Trump administration had chosen to follow in the footsteps of its predecessor. On Monday, the Department of Justice revealed that it would continue to defend the Biden administration's change to allow the pills to be distributed through the mail. This was drastically different than when Biden took office. He was still mandating that you have at least one doctor visit. When the abortion pill first came on the market, you had to have 3 different consultations with your doctor. And now we've completely wiped that away. One telehealth conversation with somebody who's not even a doctor, a couple of days later, it's in your mailbox, and you might be hemorrhaging on your bathroom floor because you are now going through an abortion of a child that might be at 16 weeks instead of 6 weeks, when that is typically the window that the abortion pill would be prescribed. And so we see that once again, this to me looks like we understand that Trump has done a lot of really good things in office, but make no mistake, he's not a social conservative. He's not convictionally pro-life. He stripped the aspirational language about pro-life being a part of the GOP platform. A few weeks before the election, Melania came out with her memoir where she, in essence, endorsed a full pro-choice message. So here we need to say, we appreciate so much of what the Trump administration has done. There has been incredible progress on a lot of the issues that we care about to make America strong, healthy, secure, and great again. But when it comes to defense of the unborn, we cannot ever follow President Trump. Jen, what do you think?
First of all, we should acknowledge that 50% of the humans that ingest this, you know, die. So the point is that it kills one of the humans, which is crazy. So you think about that safe, effective, it kills a human being. That's the point. And we shouldn't be too surprised that it's so horrible for women to take it too. But it blows my mind. I think, didn't Alliance Defending Freedom take this up to the Supreme Court, or they tried to take it somewhere? I think I remember Kristen Wagner talking about saying you should have to talk to a medical professional before you take a medication that you could be potentially bleeding out on your bathroom floor, like you said. And it doesn't seem like that should be controversial, even to the other side, you know, the more progressive left-leaning side that said they used to say they wanted abortion to be safe, legal, and rare. Not that they don't want it. They don't want it rare. They obviously want it legal, but now they don't even care if it's safe. So it sounds like that's pretty crazy. And we talked about, well, you wrote this on your Substack when we talked about the study, 2 out of 3 abortions are from chemical abortions these days. They're not going into, not that that was great either, but I mean, at some level, they had some sort of standards for medical care when you go to a clinic. And now it's just like you said, it's the mailbox and I'm going to do it myself.
Yeah. And it has led to some very, very scary situations for women who are being lied to about this. And before, I mean, I remember like we would talk to pro-life call centers or pro-life advocates, and they're like, it's incredible the number of phone calls we are getting from women who have taken the abortion pill who are now having these terrible, scary symptoms. And they thought that they were just going to you know, it was going to be easy. They were going to like pass this pass through, but they now have a dead baby on their bathroom floor and they're totally freaked out. And then they find out that there's remnants of that child or of the placenta that is left in their uterus. And then they have to go to the emergency room because they have sepsis. And so, you know, it was interesting because some of those cases that were very famous, like Amber Thurman, who allegedly died from the Georgia pro-life bills where she couldn't get medical care. Most of those are women that took the abortion pill at home because they didn't have a conversation with their doctor. And then they had to have emergency action and ultimately could not be saved from what the abortion pill did to their bodies. Now, we had them before us. We want abortion pills banned completely, not based on whether or not it affects the woman's health, which it clearly does, but because, like you said, Jen, it kills 100% of the people that are involved in that medication. It is always an injustice against children. We always must protect children. But interestingly, things do, the needle does tend to move when you can show harms to women. And so it is an important angle to say that this is also harming women. Previously, that reality had been covered up by some weak, old, very sanitized clinical trials, but now it is obvious that this is dangerous, not just to children, but to women as well. Let's hit this next story, which shocked me. I want to talk about this case in Maine, where a woman has been stripped of her right to take her child to church. And Emily is the mother of a 12-year-old daughter. Her daughter's father, Matt, they were never married, and Emily wanted to start taking her daughter to church. Matt listened to some of the sermons and read some of the websites and said, wait a second, I don't want her listening to sermons about wrath or spiritual warfare or sin or the biblical position on marriage, sexuality, and probably things like abortion. And he got the court to, in essence, say, Emily cannot go to church, any church without, I'm sorry, the child can't go to any church without the father's approval. And so this has never happened before where we have had a court say, you cannot take your child to church. This really does interfere with the parental right to direct the upbringing of the child. And it's stunning. Jen, do you have thoughts on this?
Yeah, so interesting. The article said one of the lawyers, you know, in 30 years of practice had never seen such a ruling. Because it is fascinating. And we will, the larger issue, of course, is that this is a man and a woman that produced a child and didn't have the intent of we're going to get married, we're going to raise the child together, we're going to align along some shared values, we're on the same team, we're going in the same direction. So now, of course, things are broken apart and there's custody battles, and it sounds like there's a lot of nastiness there. But it is weird in the case of parents where they split up and one parent tries to transition the child, which feels like kind of the same thing. It's the same sort of religious belief, and I'm going to pursue it this way. And we see courts siding with that parent who's doing the actually more extreme worldview ideological thing. And here they're siding with the parent who's saying they don't want anything. So it's not consistent the way the courts are doing it either.
It's interesting because the courts, I'm sure, are trained to say, okay, well, the father who doesn't want the child to go to a church, well, he's neutral. But the mom who wants the daughter to go to a traditional church, well, she's radical. They even said, oh, this is a cult. You know, we've got to rule this way because it's a, as if just saying that life begins at conception, men and women are different, and marriage has a critical function as it relates to the foundation of society, as if that's cult-like. But it really does come from this secular perspective that secularism is neutral, but religion, that's biased. When the reality is the father almost certainly has strongly held beliefs that function as a religious worldview, but he just does not go to an organized church. And yet his positions are, I am sure, extremely radical. Just like you said, the split between one mom that wants to trans the kid and the dad that says, I would like my child to not be chemically or surgically mutilated. So we have got to watch these cases closely. Parental rights are absolutely under attack. I will be surprised if this court decision stands, but we need to be on guard because we as parents are the greatest protectors of our kids, and it needs to stay that way.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
We are back at Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust. I'm joined with my training director, Jen Friesen, and we are discussing some of the trending news that's taking place across the country over the last week or two. We just covered this shocking case of a judicial ruling in Maine that said that a mother cannot take her daughter to church over the objections of the secular anti-Christian father. And it's not unusual for children who grow up in two different homes to develop two different lives because the parents are not on the same page. They're not on the same page when it comes to things like small things like screen time or sugar limits. But very often they are in two completely different worldviews. One is a ardent, you know, MAGA supporter, and the other one is like the Bernie bro marching in the, you know, women's rights movements or the women's rallies or the anti-Trump or the oppose Elon Musk or whatever it is. So it's unfortunately the case that children have to live in these split worlds. So that is a really big problem when it just happens on the personal level. But it's a bigger problem when the state, with the power of the purse and the power of the gun, puts their finger on the scale towards one of the parents, especially the parent that is not acting in the best interest of the child. So we want to talk about a couple shocking bills that have come before the Colorado legislators to make a decision. Both of them have to do with the gender issue. And this is relevant because there are several states across the country that have, in essence, become a gender identity refugee state, where if you do have a dispute with your husband or wife or ex-husband or ex-wife about whether or not the child who is experiencing gender confusion should be able to undergo these radical, irreversibly damaging treatments, one of those parents, for example, the mother, could abscond with the child to a state like Colorado, and it functions as a sort of sanctuary state, where then if the father says, wait a second, I don't want my daughter to have a double mastectomy so that she can conform to a male identity. Well, Colorado would say, if these bills are passed, we are here on the side of justice for the transgender child, and that mandates that we protect them from the parent who says they should not be surgically and chemically mutilated. So it is like upside down land, okay? What's going on in these states is absolute just insanity from a biological perspective, from the perspective of parental rights, from the perspective of the child's rights. But what we've got going on here is Colorado, who has just gone very, very far as it relates to protecting so-called transgender identities. Jen, do you want to give us a little insight into what it is that Colorado's trying to do here?
I'd love to. All right. This bill in Colorado, it was heavily amended to even be able to get passed, but it made it illegal to refuse to refer to someone by his or her, which is hilarious that they're using those pronouns even, to refer to his or her preferred pronouns or to address them by their birth name if they've changed their name. And so the bill is aiming to add misgendering, quote unquote, and dead naming, meaning someone using someone's actual name, to Colorado's Anti-Discrimination Act. So putting it under the same categories as being racist or sexist, right? And I think it's not that big of a jump to abuse. It was interesting. One of the ways that they amended it is they removed the part of the law that said Colorado could remove children from their parents' custody for dead naming them or misgendering them. And so that was a little too far for them. But they even had LGBT groups urging the more liberal side to remove some of those provisions that were a little too extreme. They're like, hey, you know, you're actually kind of pushing a little too far for us. That's a little too extreme even for us. And you're going to make people turn against us. And yeah, framing this as parents that don't go along with their children's delusions are being abusive, and you're going to go need some re-education training, and we're going to take your kids away. It's pretty scary when you see the state, the government, pitting itself against parents in such a stark way.
Yeah. We have had friends of Them Before Us go to the Capitol to try to speak, testify, protest. There has been several churches that have spoken up. You know, our allies there at Focus on the Family have done videos on this and written about it. And it's interesting because the legislators don't care. Like, they have all throughout this process just mainstream, fast-tracked this bill. They've limited the amount of comments and testimony. They have shut off the committee hearings for people to be able to participate, even though it is very obvious that there is a groundswell of opposition to this, not just from churches, not just from pro-family groups, but even, like you said, from mainline LGBT groups who are like, okay, listen, you are going so far, so fast, and we don't agree. And also, it's kind of bad for us. Like, it makes us look bad because, like, spoiler, there's a bit of a rift between the LGB and the T. If the T is real, then LGB actually does not exist. If what does T mean? T means that male and female are fungible, right? One can become the other. A male can be a woman can be a man. And that actually runs afoul of the L, the G, and the B, which all rely on a gender binary. What does it mean to be an L, a lesbian? That means you are concretely a woman who is attracted to other women. And it's interesting because the T has worked their way into a lot of the L spaces and said, well, I identify as woman, therefore I can be in your lesbian-only bars or your lesbian or female-only apps. And it's interesting because, like, you see lesbians all the time talk about how their dating apps have been overtaken by men who identify as women, right? You've got this crusty, nasty, like, beer-bellied man with kind of long hair and a 5 o'clock shadow and eyeshadow on these apps saying, you know, 40 something lesbian looking for a good time. And the women are like, yeah, I actually don't do that kind of thing. And then the lesbians are called bigots because they will not choose to date or have a sexual encounter with somebody who's very clearly a man. So in a lot of ways, the L, the B, and the T, the L, the G, and the B are pissed at the T.
Yeah.
Jen, what is going on in this space of the fracture that we are seeing on the socially progressive left?
Yeah, I mean, it's so fascinating to see this snake eat itself, right? Because they were all united at some level. They were calling all of us on the more right homophobes and bigots and transphobes because we acknowledged, no, there's male, there's female. Those distinctions mean something. We're talking about with marriage. We're talking about Obergefell. Marriage means something to children because it's the only institution that, well, one man and one woman is the only way to produce a child, right? And so I'm fascinated by trans, so men who are identifying as women, then, quote, mansplaining and the patriarchy and all the terms we want to use of men, bad men, now coming for lesbians and using all the same things against them now. You're a transphobe because you don't want a woman with male genitalia in your dating app, right? The whole lesbian thing, they're kind of like, that's the whole point is that I don't want male genitalia. And at some level, I understand we have to do this whole gaslighting thing for the rest of the world. So they're saying, well, we know you're a woman, but we still don't want, wink, wink, we don't want to date you. And yeah, you can be a true woman, but you can't be on our dating site because they're acknowledging, they know the whole time that we were right. Men and women are different. These distinctions matter. And it's like Jillian Michaels and all, Dave Rubin, right? The famous gay people who have sort of been red-pilled. But you guys helped bring this about. Just so you know, you called us bigots 2 seconds ago, and now you've agreed that we are right on some things and you're starting to move our way. It's kind of hilarious. Well, it'd be hilarious if it wasn't so scary and sad.
Yeah, it's so interesting because there's a split among feminists. And, you know, you do have some of the feminists that are like, no, this is the next stop on the progressive train and we need to support trans rights and trans women are women. But then you have the feminists that are like, no, female is a thing and you are not it. And so they've created a slur just for the feminists that will not get on board. They call them TERFs, trans exclusionary radical feminists. And like you said, it's very interesting because the feminist train has gotten us through a lot of these different, like, shredding of the social fabric. But now they're like, oh, wait a second. We want this part of the cloth to hold together. Like, this is the part where we're going to say, not enough. And we at Them Before Us would say, I'm sorry, but almost every stop on that train has required that children sacrifice for adults. But now when we're getting to the point where it's very obvious that women are being forced to sacrifice for this new social experiment, that is where you're saying, we're uncomfortable with this. It's gone too far. So we are in the place where we're like, let's just get back to biological reality. Men can't become women. Women can't become men. Those things are really different. A man and a woman make a baby. The baby needs the man and woman. Therefore, marriage matters because it is the only relationship that unites the two people to whom children have a natural right. By the way, children's bodies also need to be protected. They need to be protected from men in their spaces, boys on their track team or competing against them on their track team. They also need to be protected from maybe one parent who says, I actually think that you're a boy trapped in a girl's body. And interestingly, it's often very socially advantageous for these women, especially to say, I have a trans child. I mean, you see this much more among women that are of the progressive persuasion than you will, you know, women in small town Iowa who are a little more on the MAGA side of things. Now, very, very interestingly, women have in many ways championed not just the gay movement, but the trans movement. And it's interesting because I was listening to this conversation between Jordan Peterson and Joe Rogan, which I think came out about a week ago. And why is it that women have championed so many of the causes that have assaulted not just children's rights, but their own rights? I mean, if the trans train keeps progressing, women lose scholarships. Women lose those places that they are supposed to occupy on, you know, progressive publicly held boards. A man can just identify into being a woman. You know, now we've got men who are like the top female CEOs in the country. I mean, like women are losing beauty pageants. I mean, every aspect, every place that women are supposed to distinctly occupy are now being taken over by men. And that has been enabled by women. So Jordan Peterson's suggestion as to why this is, why is it that so many of the Colorado legislators who are pushing this forward are women, progressive women? Why is that? And he would say, rightly, I believe, that women, all women, whether you identify as straight or lesbian, whether you are progressive or conservative, women are wired to nurture and protect things that are vulnerable. That is why we are such good mothers. That is why men don't do what women do with infants, which is nurture, protect, empathize, and then cut anybody that would dare to get close to our baby. So that's what women do. The problem is we now have a whole generation of largely progressive women who are childless, but they need somebody to baby, and they need somebody to nurture, and they need somebody to protect. And so now they see this new supposed victim group, these trans men who have suffered, or these gays that have suffered. And oh my gosh, you know, they need protection and they need nurturing and they're crying. And we care for things that are crying because you are. You're made to cry. You're made to care for crying babies, especially. But what we're seeing is women have taken that natural, beautiful, wonderful pro-social empathy and they are now protecting people that shouldn't be protected. Right. And the way Jordan Peterson talks about this is women are wired to care for crying infants, but not everything that cries is a baby. Sometimes the things that are crying are monsters. And that's what we've got. We've got adults who are sometimes predators and sometimes just don't need to be coddled, who are now posing as the babies that need the women's protection. What do you think about that, Jen?
That is blowing my mind. There's kind of, I don't know, like attackers that will leave a recording of a baby crying outside of your door to get people to come out of the house and see.
Oh, that would work for me. I would be that person. They should use that on me.
Well, definitely don't fall for it. Look out the peephole or whatever. But it's fascinating analysis. And it's interesting too, because flip it. If you have a bunch of single men, you have a lot more violence, a lot more aggression. And you're seeing they're not, neither of these are necessarily bad things, the male desire to be aggressive or competitive and the female desire to care for people, but they're not being harnessed into family and protection of family or complementing each other in a marriage. And they can really run rampant in our culture and be used in or manipulated in ways they shouldn't be. It's really fascinating. And I'm also struck by the idea of the social contagion element, which is really interesting because that's impacting girls on the inside. It's not the women who are advocating for trans ideology, but the ones that are being targeted with it, the ones who are transitioning. And, you know, all around you, you're being told being a woman is the worst, or they are mistreated, or it's dangerous to be a girl in your home or school or whatever. And they think, well, I can say I'm a boy and then that'll be better. But we're seeing entire friend groups transitioning. And that means it's not an inborn sex, intersex kind of situation, you know, and someone who discovers, quote, discovers their trans at 13, that's not meeting the markers for gender dysphoria, you know, in the DSM-5 diagnosis. It's the reality is your friends are watching TikTok or you're watching TikTok and you feel uncomfortable in your body.
You actually see those differences before birth. Like they've done brain scans of kids that are still in utero and the brains of men and women are different, even when there's absolutely no social influence. That continues through infancy. You know, you have infant babies who girls, little, you know, 4-month-olds will more likely turn towards a human face, whereas infant boys will turn towards objects in motion, like fans or cars, like wheels. And you see it moving all the way through into adolescence. Like you said, girls are much more susceptible to social contagion. You know, when I was a teenager, it was anorexia. And then when we were doing youth ministry in the early 2000s, it was cutting. And now it's transitioning. Girls are just sucked into a lot of the social trends in ways that boys are not. And then you get these women who have grown up and they don't have a place to put their maternal instincts, their caregiving instincts, but they don't stop being women. They don't stop wanting to nurture and protect something that is helpless. And now we have created almost a religious channel for progressive women to protect what they perceive is the vulnerable group. And that is, unfortunately, a lot of predatory men that would like to overtake female spaces to the detriment of women and children. Thanks for being with us. We're going to take a quick break, and then we are going to come back for the questions you have sent in through the week.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
Welcome back to Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us, here with my training director, Jen Friesen, who among her many tasks, including running our church curriculum, handling all of our social media, also spends the week listening to what you have to say about what's happening in your world of marriage and family and children. And then she brings some of the top questions to the show. So that's what we're going to do now. We are going to have a virtual coffee with you talking about some of the things that's at the top of your mind. So Jen, what is it that we're covering in this final segment?
Okay, today we've got a question about divorce. We've got a question about screens and social media. And then we're going to hit our and not or campaign.
Oh, great.
So the first question, what do we, as Them Before Us, say are the moral reasons for divorce? And if you have to get divorced, what are the ways to mitigate the harms of divorce for your kids?
Very good question. So at Them Before Us, we take a very clear, forceful stance against no-fault divorce. And let's just talk a little bit about what no-fault divorce is. No-fault divorce is an evolution away from what we used to call at-fault divorce. And even before we had a civil code saying, here are the reasons why you can get divorced, we can go way back and see religious exemptions for religious permissions for dissolving a marriage or breaking up a marriage. So it began with, you know, if we look back from the Christian tradition, God hates divorce. He talks about that in Malachi. Jesus goes on to reaffirm the creation mandate that man and woman leave their mother and father, be joined to their husband or wife, and nobody separates that. So he reiterated that marriage should be permanent, recognized that Moses permitted divorce in certain cases because of the hardness of heart, he would say. Later, biblical writers would say the only legitimate biblical reason for a divorce would be sexual infidelity or abandonment by a unbelieving husband or wife from a believing spouse. So that's sort of the biblical grounds. Moving forward, both Catholic and Protestant thinkers also recognized extreme cruelty as grounds for divorce or separation at minimum. And that's what we would call abuse. So all throughout history, you've got abuse and infidelity as some of the major areas to permit the dissolution of a marriage. Then moving into kind of our civil code, our civil law, we added a few other options, possibilities to look at the dissolution of a marriage. And it would be abandonment, like if somebody abandoned the spouse, or if there was addiction involved, if there was severe alcoholism or drug use or drug abuse. So all of those different categories, right? Adultery, abandonment, abuse, addiction. Those tended to tip a court in favor of saying one of these spouses is at fault for breaking their promise to have and to hold through better for worse, in sickness or in health, until death do us part. So there was a presumption that it was going to be permanent because you made the vow. And then courts recognized that sometimes somebody was at fault of breaking that vow. And then what would happen? All of culture and the courts would side with the innocent spouse, the one that wasn't toking, the one that wasn't hitting, the one that wasn't abandoning, the one that was staying true to their vows of fidelity. And in that sense, that at-fault system functioned as a deterrent for people that wanted to get divorced because there was punishment, there was consequences. But then we moved into the era of no-fault divorce, where there didn't have to be abuse, addiction, adultery, abandonment to have the court say, yeah, go your separate ways. And so what we see now is the vast majority of cases, probably around 70%, take place, break up a marriage where nobody's at fault. Somebody just fell out of love or they don't want to work it out or whatever. And at Them Before Us, we spend a lot of time talking about how that harms kids. So we would say that there are times for, we would agree with the at-fault position, that there are times where at minimum separation, sometimes divorce needs to take place for the sake of protecting the innocent spouse and the kids. So Jenna, I'd love to hear your thoughts on what you think. If somebody does have to get a divorce, what can parents do to try to make it a little easier on the kids?
Just one note on no-fault divorce. I remember I asked this question to you a long time ago and you helped me think through it. People will say, what about abuse? You know, I can't prove it, or I'm going to be stuck in an abusive marriage. I can't leave my abusive spouse. Because if the no-fault rules are there, it makes it much harder. It's, a lot of people say that. And you talked about how even if no-fault divorce makes it easy and you're leaving because of abuse, you're still not able to protect your kids in the eyes of the law if abuse isn't the reason and there's not some kind of documentation. And I'm saying this is the reason I'm leaving. You're leaving your kids exposed to the abuser. They're probably still going to get 50% of custody. So, you know, some people automatically think no-fault divorce protects you from abuse because I can get out quicker. And maybe the adult can get out quicker, but it doesn't protect the kids. So that was one thing I remember you talked to me about. I've liked the idea. I've seen this where divorced parents, well, first of all, co-parenting should not be high conflict. Your kids should be able to go to a baseball game or their graduation and have you be in the same place without them thinking, or they should be able to take a picture of you together without feeling that you guys are going to freak out or get mad at each other and all these kinds of things. And I think that requires a lot of grace, often from the wronged party a lot of the time, right? And I've seen this too, where the mom and dad will keep the family home that's the same, and the mom and dad will leave based on their custody arrangement and come back and forth and not ship their kids back and forth between two bedrooms and two sets of clothing and things like that. I think that's huge. Things like sharing a calendar, making sure they have access to the other parents, grandparents, and family. And it requires both adults be adults and say, it's going to be best for our kids if we keep that as much as possible. Even if I'm angry at you for cheating on me, even if I moved on and fell in love with my secretary and have a new life, I'm still going to do what I can. Parents fighting over money and trying to strip the house and the cars from the other parent, it's so sad. I mean, your kids, you're not just attacking your spouse. It's your kids that feel that.
Yeah, I would agree with all of that and add, you know, we've been in ministry for many decades and we have seen divorces take place and we have seen marriages struggle. And obviously it's never completely one-sided, but it is often one-sided in the dominant sense. It is very often one adult, one parent that doesn't want to do the hard thing. And one parent that really is trying to work it out and willing to go to counseling and trying to like adjust things and do what they can within their power to improve the marriage, and one spouse that is not. And so it's interesting to me that so much of the divorce narrative is well, we're unhappily married, but then we can be happily divorced. Or, you know, we're arguing at home all the time, but we're not going to argue once we divorce. And you guys are psycho. You're crazy if you think that that's how it goes. Like, I'm living in the real world. Sometimes you can have high conflict marriage or people that are frustrated or hate each other or whatever, who then amicably co-parent. But most of the time you go from warring, fighting, jealous, frustrated married couples to warring, fighting, jealous, frustrated, divorced people. But then your child has to be the go-between. They have to be the mediator between you guys because you still haven't figured out how to work it out. So again, we understand there are some cases where divorce might need to take place, and then you have got to do everything you can, especially if you're, like you said, Jen, the wronged spouse. You've got to be careful not to trash talk the other parent. And I've seen the kids where it is very clear that one parent is in the wrong, the other parent really did their best, and now they're growing up in those split homes where often the misbehaving parent talks so much trash against the innocent parent. And I have just encouraged the innocent parent to say, answer their questions honestly, but never in a way that derides or is derogatory towards the other spouse. And I've done this long enough to now see those kids grow up. And once they get to be teenagers, and sometimes, you know, in their early 20s, they go, oh my gosh, my father lied to me. He lied the whole time. Or, oh my gosh, my mother said so many things about my dad that were not true. And now I'm starting to see it myself. But man, when you're in the midst of it and you're the divorced parent and you're operating with integrity and the other one is not, it's just soul crushing, not just for you, but for your kids too.
Okay, next question. Someone would like to know what were your family rules, parenting rules about phones, screen time, social media, when you were, I know you're still, you have two kids at home, but you know, with the advent of screens.
We talk a lot about this in our second book, Raising Conservative Kids in a Woke City, that was co-authored with Stacey Manning. And we kind of talk about what is it that we allowed? What did we not allow? And we don't necessarily come out in the same place in terms of when to give your kid a cell phone, when do you give them access to social media. Our big message is, regardless of what age you put that at, what limits you put that at, what kind of protections that you have in terms of software on your devices, training. Train, 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 train. You don't just put them in front of a movie. You don't just hand them a tablet. You don't just buy them a phone. You train them. You train them to think about what they are seeing. You train them how to use the advice. You train them in terms of dangers that are out there. I was just having a conversation with one of my kids who plays a lot of Minecraft. And I was like, hey, do you ever have conversations on Minecraft with strangers, with people you do not know in person? And he goes, nope, I've limited the settings. The only people that can come in are friends. The only time that doesn't work is if I'm playing with one of my friends that I know and they also have friends. I'm like, okay, just so that you know, some of your friends' friends could be 47-year-old men that live in Nicaragua. Okay, just to let you know, like a lot of the profiles that you're seeing on social media are not who they say that they are. So you train, you put the different pieces in place, and then you constantly check in with them. You know, there's a lot of stuff happening in the world right now with sextortion, where you've got people that are reaching kids on social media online for the sake of extorting them, getting them to do things on camera that then you can manipulate and in essence, like get cash payments from them or then be lured into some kind of terrible exploitive or trafficking situation. So you, the parent, have to be up on all of that. You have to train them ahead of time. We talk a little bit in Raising Conservative Kids in a Woke City about how your general disposition towards kids as it relates to everything, but including media, needs to be filtering out distortions up until the age 10 or 11. But then it's 11, 12, 13, you are going to introduce them to the distortions. You're going to introduce them to the dangers. You're going to introduce them to the ideologies that want to hunt them down and destroy them. Your kids should be wise as serpents, and you can still keep them innocent as doves. And then all of that training, in my opinion, the dominant training on screens, culture, media, phones, that training awareness needs to happen in middle school. And by the time they get to high school, you should have trained them to the point where you can back off and function as a consultant, where they now have enough wherewithal, enough experience, enough understanding to start to navigate the world on their own and come back to you when they have questions. So we've got a lot more details about that in Raising Conservative Kids in a Woke City.
Yeah, I've had parents in my sphere that they give their kids a phone. They don't have social media. in much more limited settings. But it's an understanding of, hey, we can look through your phone whenever we want because we want to protect you. But that's understood ahead of time. That's kind of a consequence that comes with the phone. With the privilege of having a phone, the parents can have that oversight. I like that more than parents that maybe secretly put monitoring things on or filters on there and kids. Then it sort of pits the kids and parents against each other versus parents that just say outright, hey, we're going to look through it together and we're going to keep an eye on things because we want to protect you from the people that are coming for you. It's not attacking the kid and saying, I know you're going to be looking at bad stuff or look for bad stuff. Honestly, the bad stuff's looking for kids, and that's how most kids fall into it. Friends or, like you said, predators in other countries and bots and all these sorts of things.
Agree with that 100%. I will also say we have this thing in our family where all six of us, you know, my husband and I and our four children, we all have the same password to our phone. So like, and they don't, but at any point, my kid could pick up my phone and see what pictures does she have? What sites is she looking at? You know, what kind of notifications is she getting? I don't think that they ever have, but I mean, we've told our kids, like, there's professional things where we need to be confidential, but there's nothing scandalous. Like if you ever looked at my phone or your father's phone, you could click on any app. I mean, even to the point where he deleted like the Fox News app because there were too many advertisements of women spilling out of their shirts. And he's like, I'm sorry, but if for some reason my kid chooses to unlock my phone and they go to the Fox News app and this is what they see, I never want them to see it. So like we have trained them like transparency, responsibility, that we've brought them slowly into this world of sort of digital stewardship and pass it on to them. Really quickly before we go, we have a campaign at Them Before Us, and it's called And Not Or, and it's premised on the idea that children need a mother and a father, not a mother or a father. 50% of children who grew up in this country today are not going to reach adulthood living with their mother and father, and we are seeing all kinds of social ills as a result. So between Mother's Day and Father's Day, we go on a war path to defend children, and we would love your help. Please go to thembeforeus.com and donate. For every monthly donor, even if you're donating $5 or $50, we will get $1,000 for every monthly donor. So please consider making a monthly contribution for this work that is defending kids in ways that nobody else has the stones to do it. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you guys next week.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.